Radio City once again. John Grayson and Rob Ross bringing you the world because it's what we do, man. Rob, how's everything going in New York?
Well, you know, we bring you the world because the world keeps turning and it's spinning right now out of control. I mean, we only did this a week ago. And meanwhile, how much has happened in such a very short span of time?
Yeah, impossible to keep track of every bit of it. And who knows? You know, again, we keep getting closer and closer, and people are now using a couple of words on the news as regards the current administration that they hadn't been using until now. We're starting to finally hear the word lie used regularly, and we're also hearing illegal. Not impeachment, but illegal. And what it all comes down to, and who saw this one coming, is not so much even the Russia deal and the Russia investigation, but Stormy Daniels. Because no matter what version of events is the one that turns out to be true, somebody did something terribly illegal. The question is, who, what's the charge, and what's going to come of it all?
Whenever there's a payoff and hush money involved,
yep,
right there the word illegal looms very large and very clear. It's big, bold, neon letters.
Right.
And afterwards, the word indictment should follow.
Exactly. And possibly, if it turns out that Cohen is the one that takes the fall for all of this, disbarment. And, you know, at this point, it's hard to see clearly how this could resolve itself and that guy still has a license to practice law in New York.
You know, it seems to me that disbarments tend to happen, but they don't seem to last.
Yeah, because also true. You can appeal them.
You know, several quote lawyers, and I'm using the term now very, very loosely, in previous well-known cases that I won't bring up because I don't want to give them the time of day, were in fact disbarred when it was found that they had in fact falsified reports and basically concocted a story that made national headlines. But meanwhile, somewhere along the lines, they were able to regain those licenses after a while.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily a death sentence.
Right. To me, disbarment means you're no longer going to be a lawyer, so you better learn how to pump gas.
Which ideally is what it should mean. So while that mess is all going on, Stormy Daniels herself finally said a little bit, and it seems like what we had talked about a couple of months back, the idea that maybe because the Trump people were saying things about the non-disclosure agreement, that the NDA may in fact be null and void, because if either party talks, it's over. And,
right.
You know, and all it takes is her not saying anything that's going to cost her $1 million at a shot.
Right. And if it's the party that drew up the NDA doing the talking, well, then they've broken their own contract. Therefore, it is null and void.
Right. So it's going to be an interesting week. I mean, it already has been, as you said, but it's not going to get any more normal anytime soon. And of course, it hasn't been normal in over a year now.
This is true. And oddly enough, talk about a non-normal week. We had another nor'easter, and I'm using that in quotes also. You know, the one thing about the hype of weather in New York is just that, it's hype. It was a really bad and inconvenient snowstorm.
Yeah.
The problem is, though, in certain pockets, it brought down more trees, it caused a few deaths in those trees falling, and more power outages, which are compounded by the power that hadn't been returned from the previous storm we had last Friday. You know, the very incapable and inept heads at Lilco and Con Edison with their endless litany of excuses, and an absentee mayor yet again, off on a tour of the United States doing God knows what. Everybody thinks it's to start to plant the seeds for his socialist run for president. God help us all.
Yeah, right.
You know, it really makes things untenable for these folks, and I feel for them, you know, because there are a lot of them are elderly, and you know, they're still snowed in, and there are power lines lying in their front yards, and they're trapped in their homes.
Yeah, well, yeah, and here we had the exact opposite happen, because you talk about the weather hype. It's usually that way in St. Louis, where they love to predict snow that's never going to happen, because they know as soon as they start talking about snowstorms, it means more people will watch more closely and spend more time sitting in front of the television going, when is it going to snow? This time, they said, well, it's probably going to rain a little bit on Sunday. Temperatures are going to be in the 40s. Everything will be fine. It's going to be wet. You should probably just stay inside. And what happened? It snowed all day. Now, the good news is it was still above freezing when the snow was coming down, so it just hit the ground and melted. But still, it snowed like crazy today and caught every single one of them with their pants down.
You know, here with these quote, nor'easters, it was the fact that, one, it didn't really hit in an affecting way during the workday.
Right.
You know, it was that annoying wet rain and snow mixture. So it made it slippery, you know, walking in the street. It hit hard in the evening. You know, it shut down the airports, and you know, that was really the problem, because by 11 o'clock on our local news reports, there were cars that were actually stranded on expressways.
Ugh.
Because it was that kind of dangerous snow, you know, slush condition that made it impossible for anyone to drive anywhere with any safety.
Right. Yeah. And we had a few cars that we saw a few cars that had slid off the road. And for crying out loud, I do not know how they did it. It wasn't that hazardous out there. And still they found a way to do it and drive off the road. But yeah, I mean, the weather itself is, it's going to be fine. And we're just now in that period where it's coming in like a lion. And a couple of weeks from now, March will in fact go out like a lamb.
Well, let us hope. I mean, we are a week away now from spring, and because it's what, next Tuesday?
Yeah.
Not this coming Tuesday, but the following Tuesday. And then, you know, I've got opening day tickets for Shea Stadium. There you go.
Named for Cuban guerrilla leader Shea Stadium, yes.
Exactly. And, of course, it's the Mets versus the Cardinals in the season opener. So that's a positive thing. And, of course, the New York Rangers are going to play the St. Louis Blues, and that's all I'll say, because both teams are just beyond suck.
Oh, man. So bad. Well, and I do have to get into one musical thing real quick that wasn't on our list, but something happened this week, and I thought, you know what? It doesn't get enough press when somebody who makes music for a living and has been making music for a living is just a damn nice guy. We always hear about this, you know, the stories about people sticking sharks into other people, and I mean, it's all the crazy shit that makes the news. I had the opportunity to talk to Jim Kerr from Simple Minds this week. What a nice dude. And it was a great conversation. It was one of those times, we've talked about this before, where you get into talking to somebody you've never met and it's like you've been friends for years.
Yeah, I mean, that's gold right there.
Absolutely. He's great.
Yeah, one of the, I can't remember who it was, from Pop Dose interviewed him recently, basically said the same thing.
Yeah.
That he's just the nicest, most accommodating, friendly, and outgoing guy alive. And, you know, when you've been at it for that long and you've had those tremendous peaks in your career and then, you know, it starts to dwindle away, you think bitterness will set in. But you know what? I think that generation of musicians and those coming out of the punk and new wave era, now that they're all in their 60s and so on, I think they have a better perspective than the musicians of the 60s.
Agreed. Yeah.
Maybe even some from the 70s. Because they know, hey, it wasn't supposed to last, but it's awfully nice that it has to this point, that people still want to talk to me or buy my records or whatever the situation is.
Did we talk about Denny Terrio, speaking of which?
Oh, Jesus, God, no.
I know. Well, I thought the same thing, and they offered me, they said, you want to talk to Denny Terrio for 10 minutes? And I said, sure, why not? And as much as, I mean, my sister used to force me to watch Dance Fever almost at gunpoint, but that conversation led me to the conclusion that Denny Terrio, probably more than any other person on the planet, knows exactly who and what he is. And he is that thing, and he's happy being that thing, and more power to him.
Good for him. I mean, at least he's not Adrian Zemed.
Yeah. Although they do look eerily similar, yes.
That's why it was such a weird thing. I was like, wait a minute, that's not Denny Terrio.
Right, right.
When Dance Fever would come on, but...
And then,
wow,
yeah, pre-TJ Hooker.
Was pre-TJ Hooker?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Because Zemed went from that to, he did TJ Hooker, and he also did Bachelor Party. Remember that?
Well, of course, but I mean, that was his saving grace.
Yeah, right, right.
Although his sleeves were pushed up in that.
Oh, yes.
Don't ever wear your suit jacket with the sleeves pushed up. You will never be able to recapture 1985. It is that simple.
Exactly. So we do have some things on the list to actually talk about this time around. And
I want to say, since you brought up music, I want to throw something in. And this came in on Friday. Record Store Day is coming up next month. And, of course, there will be a special Big Star release.
Yes.
For Star Day. And I think you know what this is.
Tell me a little bit more about it, because I saw the release.
It is the re-release of the Chris Bell I Am the Cosmos, You and Your Sister single in the original picture sleeve
right.
on the Car Records label. This is overseen by Chris Stamey as well. The original Car Records contract is included in this little package and the press release that went out with it. And it's going to be a very nice, neat little package. So it is something to have in your collection. Now, of course, I have the actual Holy Grail. I do have the original I Am the Cosmos single. But this is still it'll be a perfect addition
yeah.
to your collection. It'll be a perfect addition to my collection, certainly.
Attaboy. And while that's coming out for Record Store Day, for the first time there will be a Led Zeppelin release involved in Record Store Day as well. And not having to do with Record Store Day, but just an album that was released late last week. I think it was Friday the 9th. They released the third of the box, what will eventually be a box set of the newly uncovered Jimi Hendrix stuff from 1967, 68, 69. And that's also, there's some gold on there. I mean, I want to tell you, these are not throwaways. And we got used to having so many of these demo CDs come out that, you know, was stuff that was never meant to be released. It was just, you know, it was placeholders for these guys to go back in and flesh out songs. This is not what this is. The new Hendrix album is a real, fully fleshed out, done album. And the songs are gorgeously produced. And there's some stuff on there that just sounds absolutely fantastic, especially the stuff Hendrix isn't singing on.
So, in other words, this is the Jimi Hendrix experience.
Yeah. And it was, there's some stuff that I think predated that either predated the Jimi Hendrix experience getting together or was done with some of his old mates just before he died. Because there are guys in there that, well, for one thing, one of the more interesting tracks is a recorded version that they did of Woodstock. And it was the day that Joni Mitchell wrote it, which means that Stephen Stills is doing the vocals. We are stardom. First recorded version of that song with Jimmy playing guitar, Stephen playing keyboards, and Joni herself playing the drums.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. And it's that. It's an album full of really interesting tracks.
Very cool. You know, since we're in the music mode already, here's the thing, people. You know, a couple of things we need to explain. One, when John and I prepare for the show, in case you don't know a little bit of the background of this, because it's always nice to actually show behind the scenes, if you will, especially since you can't physically see us.
Yep.
What we like to do is during the span of a week between shows is to toss ideas back and forth as to what the criteria will be and what we'll talk about. You know, we usually compile a list and kind of check it off as we're talking. In this case, so much happened by the time that I had sent my first list of submissions to John on Wednesday.
Yeah.
It was already how many items long? Like about 10 things, at least 10 or a dozen things. So that's number one. Number two, what you are hearing now is show number 55 is actually show number 56 because, once again, technology has, in the parlance of professionals everywhere, fucked us royally.
Yes.
When it says to you on a machine, do you want to delete X amount, and you say yes, that doesn't mean erase everything.
Erase everything in that, and everything's gone, exactly. So we did miss one, and one of the things that we missed during the recorded issue number 54 that never will see the light of day because it's just flat gone now is our discussion about the JQ.
Oh, yes. A highly offensive topic.
Yes.
Well, John, why don't you tell our listeners what the JQ is? And you can, I think you don't have to whisper it.
Yeah, right. The Jewish question. And right. It's something that actually came back up in the news a couple of times over the last week or so. you talk about things like the what is it, the protocols of the Elders of Zion and all of the bullshit that has come up over the years that has been part of this, you know, what exactly is the Jew and what is his role in the world, which is just as offensive as you could possibly be right from the outset.
You can add to that now with the, you know, with the white power nationalist movement.
Right.
Or it's also whether or not Jews can be even considered white.
Or people. So, depending on what time frame.
Well, I mean, the whole thing with the Jewish question, quotation marks, goes back to 1750, and of all places, of course, Great Britain.
Yep.
Surprise, surprise. Which appeared during the Jew Bill of 1753 debates. This is not a joke. This is real. And then the French took up the question with La Question Juive after the French Revolution. So obviously I have nothing good to say about the frogs.
Right.
Because we all know that they're all a bunch of anti-Semites. I mean, it was personified by the fact that their two biggest gods happen to have been Jerry Lewis and Woody Allen. Right? And then, of course, it came to Germany in 1843 through the treatise known as Die Judenfrage, which, of course, is the Jewish question.
Right.
So, and of course, somebody like Karl Marx, who espoused his anti-Semitic views, make it even more ironic because the fact is Karl Marx was indeed a Jew.
Yep.
So now you've got one of those people fanning the flames. Now, all of this, and we don't even need to go into the element of the Jewish question as part of the final solution. What's the question? How do we get rid of them?
Right.
Was Hitler's thing. But now we're talking about very modern parlance, and you know, there are a whole bunch of new, I don't even know what you want to call them or refer to them as, there's a new fanning of the flames, because of course, you know, you've got on the one side the typical white power, I don't even know what you want to call it, it's part of the white power's makeup. You know, it's yeah. always going to be the Jews, the blacks, the Catholics, but always the Jews.
Yeah. And they, I mean, they lump the Catholics in because, I mean, where's the center of Catholicism? Rome, in the middle of Italy. So again, they're not quite white. You know, it's just ridiculous.
And of course, you know, part of the new left or the extreme left, they're all pretty well known to be virulent anti-Semites.
Yep.
And they too have the Jewish question as part of their task. It's ironic that their Lord and Savior at the moment happens to be a Jew, even though he, you know, he only uses it for convenience. And the other cretin who ran for president just to take votes away from Hillary Clinton, that other communist Jew, Dr. Jill Stein, well, the Jewish question in and of itself, there is no question. I'm a Jew. Come get me.
Right.
You want to try. We'll see what happens. Because you'll get me after you pry my gun out of my cold, dead hands.
Yes, it's a come at me, bro, kind of moment. And the thing is, I mean, there's so much history behind this and so much idiocy that has gone on. And why is it that we keep going down the same old roads? And I will never be able to understand it. We throw around that quote about how people who forget their history are doomed to repeat it. But it's like nobody understands what that means.
Well, that's all too true and all too tragic, because, of course, it does lead to the same kinds of repeated actions and insanity, if you will. But the thing is, historically speaking, the Jews are always the scapegoats. Anytime anything goes wrong, blame the Jews.
Yeah. You know?
Blame the Jews because they allegedly run the media and they allegedly run all the banks.
Well, just remember, there's blame to go around on many sides. On many sides.
There's a lot of bad hombres out there. A lot of bad hombres.
Oh, and it would be, I mean, here we are laughing about it, but it's one of those things that you have to, because if you think about it too long, you're going to just start crying.
If I thought about it too long, I'd have had a life, I'd probably be in jail for having killed half the people who called me Jew bastard growing up.
Exactly.
Know? I mean, it would eat your guts up, but you know what? I say very proudly, I'm a Jew. And so therefore.
Yep. And let's not even talk about Simon Bar Sinister, because that's a...
Remember, we got into that in an episode. Right. Between Simon Bar Sinister, he's short, he's a mad scientist, obviously a Jew doctor.
Yep.
And he's got those baggy eyes, you know, that, you know, and, you know, and with a name like Shimon Bar Sinister. If that isn't Hebraic, I don't know what is. He's probably an Israeli. And his sidekick, Cad.
Yep.
But don't forget Riff Raff, who sounds like he just fell off of the Latke truck.
Yep.
Just came from the mother country. And his sidekick, Mooch, who looks like Walter Matthau. People, if you don't know what we're talking about, watch Underdog, please.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, get yourself an education in cartoons, because that's where all of our actual culture stems. Exactly. Right. It's where all the Jews are.
That's where money is.
Don't
forget, of all of them, Yosemite, or as I would point out, Yosemite Sam. Yosemite Shmuel, huh?
Well,
bearded, always penny pinching.
Uh huh. Well,
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. And you look at where all of the conspiracy theories and all of the bullshit comes from. Not only the Elders of Zion stuff, but who do they go after? Well, the international bankers, code word for what exactly? Oh yeah, the Rothschilds, who were what again?
Jews,
right? And the Bilderberg Group, and yeah, it's all supposedly run by Jews. And so what does their guy, the one who was the choice of the alt-right, what does he do? He puts some kid in charge who is not only Jewish, but is completely incompetent.
So, which Jew in his cabinet? Are you referring to his son-in-law?
His son-in-law, yeah.
And don't forget now, he's got a converted Jewish daughter.
Well, right. And one of the Jews in his cabinet quit this week because he's an idiot. Now, I mean, not the one who quit, because Trump is an idiot.
That's a big idiot. Because it's big idiot, little idiot, little idiot. But the thing is, the little idiots need names. We know who the big idiot is.
Yeah, the little idiot in this case was Gary Cohn, who quit because Trump decided to... Here's the funny part. They said, well, you know, Gary Cohn was ready to quit over the thing that happened in Charlottesville, Virginia, where Trump said, oh, you know, there's blame to go around on many sides. That he did. They talked him down off the ledge on that one. But he quit this week because Trump passed the tariffs on steel and aluminum. So, you know, anti-Semitism and praising or at least putting, you know, protesters on the same level with neo-Nazis, that's okay. Tariffs, though, that's a bridge too fucking far. What?
Well, it's money. You know how Jews are. Yeah.
I forgot. I'm sorry. You'll have to forgive me on that one. But he wasn't the only Jew. In fact, he wasn't the only Jew tied to the Trump administration that was in the news this week as well. When that shill, Nunberg, when that story came out. Tell me your take on this.
I thought it was just bizarro comedy. It was like watching a bad sketch from Saturday Night Live or Friday. Well, Fridays, actually. It would be more apt. I mean, I really couldn't tell if he was drunk slash high or if he's just a barking lunatic.
I don't think he's either one. I think he's a plant.
Interesting.
Here's where I see this thing happening. So Nunberg came out. First of all, who the hell is he? Before Tuesday, nobody had heard of this guy. He had been gone from even the campaign since 2015. Gone from the Trump Organization, fired from the Trump Organization in 2015. After working for them for 5 years, all of a sudden he comes out and says, they subpoenaed every email. I'm not going to spend 80 hours vetting my email. And I'm thinking, first of all, it doesn't take 80 hours. It takes about 8 minutes to do a name search in your email. Any schmuck would know that. So he trumps up this ridiculous, idiotic reason not to comply with the subpoena from Bob Mueller's office. And it starts
it says
stamping his feet.
That he's not going to testify.
Exactly. Ended up doing Friday anyway, and we all knew he would. But he said, oh, if they throw me in jail, they throw me in jail. And I'm thinking, okay, what is this guy's game exactly? And then 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Tuesday, as all of this is going down, and this guy's saying, I'm not going to go in there, and it's not even for Trump. I hate Donald Trump. He fired me. And he's showing up on every TV station by phone, and then finally shows up in the studio on CNN about 7 o'clock at night.
And on Fox, too.
Right. And he showed up with Aaron Burnett. Now, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the Trump administration, through Sarah Ridiculous Sanders, starts saying, well, you know, the guy's got problems. He's a drunk and all of this. So what happens? He shows up on CNN and Aaron Burnett says, you know, I'm sitting across from you and you smell like alcohol. I mean, it was perfect. It was right down the line perfect. And I thought, this guy's a shill. What they're doing is they're trying to see if Trump says no to a subpoena, will Bob Mueller flex some muscle and go after him? And so what do? You find some idiot that you have plausible deniability of any, you know, any contact with for at least a couple of years. You have him do it and you see just how serious they are. And apparently they were really serious because they went to his lawyers and said, if he wants to spend the rest of his life in prison, fine, but, or something to that effect. And so they were like, oh, okay. He was the trial balloon. And as final witness to this, when was the last time somebody went on TV and said, I hate Donald Trump like poison, like 47 times, and Trump didn't tweet about him once?
Interesting. You know, that's a really good theory. Now, to address the one elephant in the room, I wouldn't mind being drunk sitting across from Aaron Burnett. Actually, I'd prefer to be sober, but...
And she's drunk. Yeah, right.
That's not appropriate, John.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's harassment, remember? Hashtag her too.
Exactly. You
know, I mean, she's just gorgeous, and you know how I'm about news babes. Uh-huh. So. Second of all, if this is the way that they operate, I give them full marks for having that kind of detail in skullduggery.
Right.
It would be better suited to actually just run the government in that manner, I would think. Be great if they could take people out, you know, the heads of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and so on with that kind of, you know, chicanery going on.
Right.
You know, rather than playing these cat and mice games with the media and with Bob Mueller. So, but, you know, look, we're not even 2 full years into this administration, and it feels like we've been running the marathon nonstop.
Right.
It is exhausting. And there comes a point where you actually turn off and just try and concentrate on, and I'm going to go out on a limb here, if any good things actually happen during this administration, there have been a few good things.
Right.
You know, so you have to take stock in that because all of this stuff is more extraneous TV bullshit. You know, all we're doing is seeing that because notice we're talking about it, even though we have a show and that's part of what we do. What we're doing is reportage, but everyone stopping to watch this and being fascinated. You know, they're watching car wreck television.
Yep.
Because it's the highest form of reality show right now.
Yeah, and that you can't screw up with everything you do. There will be positive repercussions no matter what your actions are, because government is that complex. And that's a problem. The real problem with Donald Trump is that he's such a blockhead. He is such a simple human being that he doesn't understand the complexities of his actions. So even with something like the tariffs, I think this is what you're talking about. I live in St. Louis. Granite City, Illinois is about 30 miles from where I'm sitting right now. And in Granite City, Illinois, there is a steel plant. And that steel plant has been largely shuttered for the last 10 years or so. And they lay people off. They bring them in occasionally and they'll fire up the boilers and do their thing. Or the furnaces, rather. And this week, as soon as the tariffs were announced, Granite City Steel said, we're going to hire 500 people right now and start firing up the furnaces and start making steel again because they can afford to do it. Now, that means that locally, 500 people are really, really happy about this because they're going to have work, and it's work doing what they were trained to do. The problem is the repercussions down the line for every other industry are miserable. So, yeah, 500 guys are real happy, but there's going to be thousands of people who are going to get fucked over by this.
True. So it's always damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Right. But there are good things, right, you know, on an individual basis that are going to happen.
If it's negative, it's coming from the left, and you know there's blame to be had on both sides,
on many sides.
Right. I mean, by the way, there's indictments apparently being prepared for Bernie Sanders and his part of taking bribes from Russia, but that's kind of noticed.
Are they going after his wife too?
I wish they would. I wish they'd just take both of them and Jill Stein to the gallows.
We did have the chance yesterday, though, to change the subject entirely. We went to the movies. We finally got to see what everybody has been yakking about. We went last week and saw Red Sparrow. This week it was Black Panther.
Okay, so Jennifer Lawrence is adorable, and that's not going to change.
Right,
good.
Right. That, by the way, is a good movie. It's not a great movie, but it's a really good movie.
On the Lost episode 54, we talked about when Black Panther finally opened and all the mega hype that went behind it before the movie actually premiered. One of my coworkers went the week that it opened.
Uh-huh.
And it was almost like everybody got quiet when he said, oh, I went to see Black Panther yesterday, because everybody wanted to hear his opinion. Lo and behold, his opinion was exactly what you and I had talked about. It might have been on the air on the prior show to see if it lived up to the hype and expectations.
Yeah.
Or whether or not it was going to be meh, as the young people want to say. And his reply was, it wasn't anything special. I don't see why there was so much hype about it. He goes, I know why there was so much hype, but it wasn't worth that kind of hype. Because simply put, he didn't feel that Black Panther, A, is a particularly sympathetic character.
Right.
You know, he's not every man, whereas, you know, and I can see it to a degree. If I remember correctly, the vague background that I know on Black Panther is that he's some kind of prince.
Right, who becomes king early on in the movie. Because and that's not ruining anything, that's just...
Right, his parents are murdered. Because it all takes place in the last, movie? In the last Avengers movie.
Right.
Because that was the setup for this. So he's not every man. He happens to be, you know, of title. And certainly the female characters were a bit more interesting, but they're really not characters that you can embrace or frankly give a damn about one way or the other. You know, when you go to these movies, if you're a fan, like I particularly liked Ant-Man. Why? Because he's a Jew. I mean, the character's not a Jew, but
Paul Rudd is, yeah.
Paul Rudd is a Jew, and so is Michael Douglas, and Evangeline Lilly ain't too bad to look at for 2 hours.
Yep.
But the point is that Paul Rudd's character is so immensely likable. You cheer for him.
Yep.
That's the point. And the same thing goes for Steve Rogers, a.k.a. Captain America.
Yes.
You cheer for him. You embrace them because their story makes you, you know, you get the setup, you get the backstory. And with this one, he's just not particularly embraceable. That's the gist that I got, that it doesn't live up to the hype.
That is true, but there's a couple of ways to look at that. And I think I liked it a lot better than your coworker did because of that. Because that part of the comic book universe was never something that appealed to me all that much. So I didn't grow up reading these comics and getting involved deeply in a lot of these stories. I would see one occasionally. So what I liked about it was that it wasn't the standard story. And the guy who ends up being the bad guy in this is a much more sympathetic bad guy than most of the ones that Marvel has given us in the past. Usually the bad guys are bad guys and they're easily identified as such. And they're kind of boring because they're really ugly. And apologies to Alfred Molina. And
you should apologize to what's his name, who played Victor Von Doom.
Right.
You know, the guy who had been in Nip Tuck.
Yeah, exactly. So not all of them, but that's usually the case, is that they look like bad guys, they act like bad guys, and most of them are bad just for the sake of being bad. This bad guy has a reason to be bad, and it's not an unjustified reason. So I found it, I was talking to a friend of mine about this, I forgot about halfway through the movie that I was watching a superhero movie. And I like that because it was different enough. And as far as the women, you're right. The two leads, Lupita Nyong'o and the other one whose name I can't remember, are there simply to represent strong women. And that's fine, but their character development was shit. However, the girl who plays the prince's little sister, she's the kind of tech genius involved in this movie. And first of all, she is incredibly hot. And second of all, she's much better fleshed out as a character. She is very likable. Her screen presence is fantastic. And if there is somebody in this movie that you can root for, It's kind of her. Her name.
Guerrera, is it?
Say again?
Danai Gurira from The Walking Dead?
No. She's a British actress, and her name is Letitia White. Letitia Wright. I'm sorry, Letitia Wright. And yeah, she really is. She's the reason to go see this movie.
Well, interesting. That's a very interesting take on it.
But as far as the hype goes, nothing is ever going to live up to the kind of hype that this movie got. And it's what I didn't think it was what we heard in that first week, which is the great black awakening in superhero movies. You know, it was like, yeah, all of the main characters are black because it's set in Africa, you know, but I didn't see it as any great power move there.
Well, speaking of, quote, strong women, and the only reason I have strong women is this week the announcement by Mattel that they're bringing out Strong Women Barbie, or as I like to call it, Pandering Barbie.
Uh-huh.
That's the one thing that would make me, if I had a daughter, I'd say to her, I'm burning your Barbie dolls.
Right.
We'll, you know what? You can play with Skipper instead. Barbie's best friend. Barbie is not welcome in this house anymore.
It's a doll. It's a toy.
It's bullshit. And by the way, the only British actress I can think of when you said totally hot, I immediately just thought of Tandy Newton because she is just.
Oh, yeah.
I can't look at her without melting. Oh, God, I want that girl. I am so in love with her. I'd leave the planet for her. Uh-huh. You know? I'd get on the space shuttle for her. I'd go to England for her, and I hate the English. You know why? Because they invented the Jewish question. So, you know. Mattel, what the fuck are you thinking?
Yeah.
Well, get your head out of your ass. Make toys and shut up. There's no political agenda here. It's a fucking toy.
Right. And that's the thing that's what really burns me up about this. And there's a connection back to the Black Panther thing with this as well. There are very deep burning questions that we have to answer in this world. And there are things that need fixing that should have been fixed hundreds of years ago. And it's sickening that they haven't been fixed yet, even by our generation. And we don't really show any gumption toward fixing them anyway. But to pretend that we're going to fix them with a movie, or we're going to fix them with a doll, or we're going to fix them by showing people role models, no matter what form we show them role models in, to pretend that that's what's going to fix the problem for us and we don't actually have to do any work is frankly just a pile of horse shit.
I completely agree with you, because the thing about role models, be your own goddamn role model.
Right.
Look at your parents. If your parents have been raising you the right way, that's all there is to it, because at the end of the day, you know, you're your own – I hate to say you're your own hero.
Yeah.
You know? You're either going to be a hero, or you're going to be a goat, or you're going to be a villain. It's one of three strengths, you know.
Well, my joke this week was, you know, it was Wednesday, I think, was International Women's Day, which only leaves us the other 364.
Jesus.
You know, it's like, come on. What is exactly is this supposed to accomplish?
When you say International Women's Day, I automatically think, look for the union label. When you are buying a coat, dress, or blouse.
Uh-huh. So, I don't know. Maybe it's a good thing that we're not still making cars that come in pink, especially for women, with extra large mirrors on the, what do you call them, on the sun visors. Yeah, we don't do shit like that anymore, but we used to.
I'll tell you what, I certainly every time I see a car that is in fact pink, and it's usually one of those Mary Kay ones,
but, right.
I think about that scene in Dirty Grandpa where they're forced to drive in the fiancé's pink Mini. as Robert De Niro's character refers to it as this, the labia on the road.
Uh-huh.
So, right.
Well, what was the movie with John Hurt and Ryan O'Neal?
Oh God, that blow dryer movie with they're like, one's a gay cop, the other one's a straight cop.
Yes. Yes, and they were riding around in a convertible pink VW Bug.
That's so good.
Oh, it was the best thing ever. So yeah, there's a lot of shit needs to be cleaned up, but let's just do that and not just put things out there and pretend. Again, it's slacktivism. It's the same thing as I'm going to change my profile picture to make it look like it's red, white, and blue in big stripes so we can all be, you know, je suis Charlie. Come on.
Yeah, well, you know what? Le question juif, fuck you.
Exactly.
Therefore, you will never see my profile picture change unless I change the picture. I'm not doing anything for anybody. I'm not putting a pink ribbon. I'm not putting a red ribbon. I sure as fuck am not putting a French flag.
Yeah, but you know, maybe we're learning something, though, because I didn't see that happen after the shootings in Florida. There wasn't some crappy Facebook meme that started to take over about how we're all Florida strong. And I'm kind of glad, because those kids actually showed what strength is.
Well, they pulled that shit after the Orlando shootings at the nightclub.
Right.
Oh, but wait, maybe these were just like normal kids and they got murdered. And, you know, that was a gay club, so that's different. So that merits a meme.
Yeah.
You know how these political agendas always go, because, you know, all I'm saying, a lot of bad hombres. That's all I'm saying. You know? But at the same time, if we want to give some honor to some women, especially because we lost this moment of the segment from episode 54, not enough credit, love, accolades, time on TV, whatever, went to the women's hockey team, the American women's hockey team,
yes,
who brought the gold. That is the pride of the United States. The ladies' hockey team brought us the gold. Guys, learn a fucking lesson. That's the second time they won it in the last 20 years, I believe.
Right, right.
And they were magnificent. They won it in an overtime game in a shootout
and
against Canada. Don't you dare start speaking Canadian.
And the young lady who scored that goal, who scored the goal in the shootout to win the gold for the U.S., that move, oh my God. I mean, there's nobody in the NHL. There is not a single NHL goaltender who'd have been able to save that shot. Wouldn't happen.
Henrik Lundqvist was in a shootout last night and the Rangers lost. End of story. That's why the Rangers lose. Don't tell me how great he is. He sucks worse than my grandmother. My dead grandmother could be a better goalie when it's a shootout than Henrik Lundqvist. Rangers are going to lose. Why? Because Henrik's in the net for a shootout.
Right. But you're absolutely right. Those young ladies should have gotten a hero's welcome when they came back to the States with those gold medals, and they didn't. And we all really ought to be very ashamed about that.
Absolutely. Those ladies are genuine heroes.
Yep.
So fuck all of you.
And of course,
if you don't give props to those women, I reiterate, fuck every single one of you.
And before we leave slacktivism entirely, the Oscars happened again.
Oh, do you hear that in the background, John? It's the sound of sucking. Everyone's blowing each other because of how wonderful they are. And I just want to say all the women should just stand up. No, they shouldn't. Just sit the fuck down and shut up and get off stage.
Yeah.
Take your award and get going.
Yep. Yeah, okay? you did your jobs. Well done.
Well, guess what? Did you see who won all the awards? They were white people.
Right.
You know why? They just happened to be the better actors. Oh, wow. Jordan Peele won best screenplay for Get Out. If that isn't a gratuitous give, I don't know what is, because that was not the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. It wasn't even one of the better. I can name about 100 shitty horror movies that are better. It was called The Stepford Wives, first of all, when they first did it.
Right.
You know? There's nothing inventive about that movie.
No. I think it was very, very well done. I enjoyed the hell of it. I will say I enjoyed that movie a whole lot more than I enjoyed the Fishfucker movie. Or Grinding Nemo. I saw somebody call it that, which is great.
Fuck.
Because I saw that thing, The Shape of Water, and it was...
Oh, yeah, Creature from the Black Lagoon, as you called it.
Yeah, right. And it was fine, I guess. But for that movie to win Best Picture, where there was so much better out there, I don't see it. And that's the thing, not only were the awards crap, but the performances themselves, it's just, you know what it is? It has overstayed its welcome the same way beauty pageants overstayed their welcome. Who watches the Miss America pageant anymore? Nobody.
Yeah, the last time I watched was when Vanessa Williams won, and look what happened to her.
Exactly. Yeah, and I would rather watch the pictures or the photo shoot.
Yes. Oh. As I was about to say, when that hit the newsstands, I was the first in line.
Damn right. Nobody watches. The only people who watch Miss America anymore are 90 plus, and it's going to be the same thing with the Oscars. They have just become such a ridiculous parody of themselves.
They're watching the Oscars because they're waiting for Burt Parks to come out and sing "There She Is, Miss America," except he's dead.
Right, right. So, yeah, no interest.
Should be watching Miss Universe then, right?
Yep. Yeah, right. Well, at least the Miss Universe pageant may serve a purpose. It may actually get somebody impeached. So there's that.
Oh, keep holding your breath for impeachment, you lefty you. But now here's the thing, and we need to go back to music because two major events did take place this week. And one is actually tied to the Oscars, and that is this very sad but not shocking, the passing of one of the true greats in the music industry.
Yep.
Russ Solomon, the founder of Tower Records, died last Sunday night, just after John and I wrapped up the last episode, of a heart attack at the age of 92 while watching the Oscars. Either it bored him to death, or, well, no, actually what happened was he asked his wife to get him another whiskey as he watched the Oscars. He was making a comment, or a joke as it were, about what someone was wearing, and when she came back in the room, he was gone.
Yeah, what a great way to go.
God, yes, but 92 years old, what a great man. I have not seen one negative thing about him. Anyone and everyone who knew him or worked for him, even the lowest clerks at Tower Records, and I don't mean, oh, they're low. I mean, that, you know, lowest on the food chain, as it were.
Right, the org chart.
Because we always have to explain these things to people. Loved him. They couldn't say enough good things about him. And it's a wonderfully touching tribute to hear someone so well loved on so many facets and levels that, you know, he seemed like a very cool guy. I never had the pleasure of meeting him. And at the same time, the New Musical Express, the last of the weekly print magazines,
The Enemy,
is now no more. It is only digital. This week was the final print edition after 50 some odd years, maybe 60 years. Who knows? That was the last one standing. After Melody Maker went a few years ago.
Yep.
So it just goes to show you how unimportant music has rendered itself too in this day and age.
Yeah, and you think about, again, anytime you go into magazines like that, what's left? You know, Rolling Stone is just sad. And you know,
is Spin even available anymore, by the way?
Is what?
Spin?
Wow. I hate to say no because it might be, but I don't think I've seen a new copy of Spin in forever. And, you know, with that, you know, Trouser Press is long gone. I mean, there were some great, great rock and roll magazines.
Trouser Press was my favorite, and certainly in my formative punk years, it was the one that was the most helpful because it was the most knowledgeable thanks to people like Ira Robbins.
Right.
Who was, of course, the founder and publisher. You know, when I was a teenager, you know, we would make the weekly trek into the city. First stop would be Rocks in Your Head and then Bonaparte's, which was where Bleecker Bobs later moved. But Bonaparte's was the first place that I was able to get The Enemy and Melody Maker and Sounds. And those three weeklies, along with Zigzag, were the main British magazines that I read because at that time there was so much new, interesting, good music happening. You know, every week it was going to be Paul Weller or Hugh Cornwell or Andy Partridge or Susie Sue or Robert Smith or Julian Cope or whomever would appear on the cover of these magazines. And it was fantastic and it was exciting because if you hadn't heard it yet, it whetted your appetite. So that way, I just read about this last week. I'm here this week to buy the album.
Right. Not to mention the fact that, you know, after... In the 1960s, the way that Paul and Linda met was she was on a photo shoot. And at that point, rock and roll photographers, even though there was some great work done, and I'm not trashing it in any way, there was some great work done. There were some beautiful pictures of that era because of the efforts of her and, some of the Rolling Stone photographers of their day when it was still a worthwhile magazine. What they did was still... in a kind of an antiquated mode. They always looked for a way to soften the scene a little bit. And when you had guys like, were you the one that introduced me to Chalky Davies?
Probably.
Okay. As a kid was working for, as a teenager was working for Enemy and learned his craft on the job and the grit and the scenes of New York and London in 1977, 78, 79, when it was, you know, to use the, I guess, the common parlance, a shithole. You know, these places were falling apart and everything was gross and grit covered and scum covered. And it made sense to put these guys in those positions because those were the kind of cockroach filled dungeons that they infested. And so that's what we got to see through Trouser Press and through Enemy and through all of those things. So, it gave you the music, but it also gave you such indelible imagery.
And, you know, it's funny, but this is one of the most wonderful things about my life in general. When I ride the ferry, it is very frequent and not surprising for me to see one of the truly greatest photographers that have ever lived getting on every now and then to head to a studio, because longtime resident of Staten Island happens to be someone who not only photographed the punk scene, but the scenes prior to that, and really, really made his bones, photographing Bowie and Bolan and Queen. And his very dear friend happened to be Roger Keith Barrett, a.k.a. Sid.
Yep.
And his name is Mick Rock.
Yes.
And Mick Rock, if you've never seen Mick Rock, the moment you see him, he's unforgettable. So to see him kind of just amble onto the ferry, and he always seems to sit a few seats away from me. Now, he happens to be a very dear friend, as well as a photographer for our friend Richard Barone. I've never met Mr. Rock, and I will not go and disturb him either when he's on the ferry.
Good. You know?
I absolutely admire him to no end, but hey, he's just doing the same thing I am, going about his daily business. But it's just great to see him being able to go out there and do his thing and knowing that he's here on the island with his next door neighbor, David Johansen. So, you know, because David still lives here too.
Yeah. Obviously.
He's a Staten Island boy. Thank God for that.
Right.
And so does Vernon Reed, by the way, who used to live actually down the street from me. But so did DeRizza from Wu-Tang.
Oh yeah, and Wu-Tang had some big news again this week. They're out there pitching some new music, and that was such an interesting business model, because a friend of mine got to do an interview with one of the members and said, you know, with a band that big, how do you keep from ripping each other's heads off? You know, there's bands that are three guys deep and they can't stand each other. How do you all still get together in the same room? And the answer was, they came up with this model early on where whenever somebody, whether it was RZA or whoever, went out to do a solo project, it was always under the Wu-Tang banner.
Right.
So they got the freedom to do what they wanted to do and still maintained the cohesion of the unit.
Which is why, you know, every week would be like, he's also in Wu-Tang. The RZA, who, you know, Bobby Digital, he the architect.
Uh-huh.
Right. The GZA, who the genius.
Right.
Obviously, he's no longer amongst us, but Old Dirty Bastard, a.k.a. Dirt.
Yeah, right.
Big Baby Jeebus. Raekwon the Chef.
Yep.
Inspector Deck. Capadonna. Who else be part of this? Who else part of Wu-Tang represent? Because, you know, down the block, because I live on a street called St. Mark's Place.
Yeah.
At the very end of St. Mark's, when you go down, there's one of the main drags of Staten Island called Victory Boulevard. And if you walk up a half block, that was where Wu-Tang actually had the original Wu-Wear store and Walking Dogs, the shoe store.
Yeah.
Those were there for years and years and years. I think they just finally gave up the clothing thing, but they did great business. Absolutely great. They're smart guys. And plus, it's always a big shout out to Shaolin.
You're right. Well,
don't
forget Method Man. I mean, you gotta
Method Man. That's right. Who else? Did we leave anybody else?
Did we mention the Killers? Master Killer and Ghostface Killer?
Ghostface Killer, that's right. That's right. So, forgot those two. I think we got everybody now, because I think that's about 10, right?
It's basically the phone book of Brooklyn. So,
Well, no, because some of those guys be from Shaolin,
right? Yeah, right.
You know.
So, so good for them. But that's, you know, there are ways to make it all happen. At least there's more good music coming out. Now, I want to skip around a little bit, because last week we talked about something that I just happened upon on my drive home. From work, and saw, and I got the word. I don't remember if I knew about this yet the last time we talked, but there was indeed a fatality, and it was the mom of this family of six. Yeah.
Said that the mother had been killed, and that the driver was an 86-year-old farmer.
Yep.
And we had the discussion about age limits, or, you know, at least repeat testing to make sure that they still had their faculties and be able to drive.
Yep.
Well, carrying on further, because as I mentioned during that conversation, which I think was at the opening of episode number 54,
yep,
if you will, that New York has basically become this, every night on the news, without fail, there's always going to be now a either a traffic fatality report or a hit and run report more often than not. And this week was yet again, and that's why I wanted us to continue the conversation. A horrific accident in Brooklyn in which a woman ran a red light, crashed into a pregnant woman, and killed another woman and her child. If I remember correctly, the woman who was injured happens to be a Broadway actress, actually.
Uh-huh.
And so that was, you know, but here's the crux of all this. This woman ran a red light. She claimed, and this is why I'm going to use the word claimed, that she had a medical issue, that she'd had a seizure. This woman, A, has had a long string of traffic violations for running red lights and speeding in school zones. And she's known for having these medical issues to begin with. Why is she driving?
Yeah.
It's that simple. Why is she she doesn't think she should she deserves any kind of jail time? Absolutely she does. I don't care that you're having a seizure. You shouldn't be behind the wheel of a car.
Right. Yeah, if you have a seizure disorder. Yeah, sure.
So, and she's on a ton of medications. But the fact is, she's done this before. She hasn't hit and killed anyone previously, but she's run red lights and sped in slow down school zones.
Yeah.
So it's been the story of, you know, that's been one of the three main stories of New York City. That and the freezing conditions and no power, and the fact that our mayor is in charge of something called NYCHA, which is the New York City Housing Authority. He's the overseer. He has a capo, if you will, who is possibly the most incompetent person I've ever seen in a New York City governmental position. And when you see the conditions that the people in NYCHA housing live under, and their requests for simple repairs, basic repairs, go unanswered, go unheeded, and the situations just get worse and worse and worse and worse. And de Blasio is just standing there praising this woman to the skies and giving her a nice big fat raise. And there is something very wrong here.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, the New York City corruption thing, we could spend show after show after show on, but it just goes to show, again, it's not left or right. I mean, there's corruption to go around all over government, and it doesn't make any difference at what level it is. And they're just as brazen about it, and they're just as unapologetic about it.
And that's de Blasio. You just brought up the key thing. He's brazen. He's unapologetic. He's arrogant. He's flippant. And God knows, he talks down to everyone there is. He now has the audacity to say that his wife should be on the payroll because she's his number one advisor.
Yeah, who does that sound like? Who else puts his family members on his payroll as his number one advisors?
Okay, now, hang on for a second. Hang on for a second. There's a difference. And, you know, you can split hairs. There's enough blame to go around on both sides. But, you know, at least Donald's president.
Yeah, ugh.
That's all I'm going to say. Oh, and by the way, speaking of family, some douchebag's stepdaughter ran for mayor of Burlington, Vermont, and got beaten by the current mayor who's going to serve his third term.
Good. Well, yeah. And have you seen his son, who is apparently running for office as well?
Yes, indeed. You mean his bastard son, who he wouldn't acknowledge for many, many years?
Yeah, he's an attractive fellow.
He's wearing his father's old clothes. Because you know how those socialist Jews are, you know, they don't spend any money.
Yeah.
But Levi Sanders, I believe, is his name. God, talk about a Jewy name. Well, good. Hopefully he doesn't get voted to anything, not even dog catcher. Anybody aligned with Bernie Sanders does not deserve to be voted. Well, then again, anybody who Bernie Sanders endorses always loses by an enormous margin, which is wonderful. He's the kiss of death.
Got to go back into the musical world, and we have a couple of things to go over as far as new music is concerned. And it's we hear some familiar names coming back into the new music segment, one of which, and again, this goes back to 54, the episode we lost, Steve Barton has new music out. Run through some of the history of Steve Barton.
Steve Barton is the, once again, I should say, because they have reconvened over the last few years, the lead singer, main songwriter for the wonderful, wonderful band Translator, who I absolutely love. And Steve's put out several solo albums over the years, like Charm Offensive and The Boy Who Rode His Bike Around the World. And now Steve's new album is, and I mean, really, it's kind of a, what did you just say when you say it? Is a 3-album set called Tall Tales and Alibis. And it's broken down into 3 segments. The first one is the more upbeat songs, if you will. The second one has a more moody vibe. And the third one is kind of the band effort. And for this, you know, his band includes people like Dave Sheff, the drummer from Translator, who is just a super lovely guy. Derek Anderson, the mega bass player, whose album we reviewed last year, his first solo album. He plays bass right now with the Bangles, plays with a ton of people. Nelson Bragg from Brian Wilson's band, Pete Thomas, as in Elvis Costello and the Attractions.
Nice.
So that's, you know, that's the core of the band that's on disc number 3. But the first one is pretty much all Steve playing all the instruments himself. And these are not demos. This is a very concerted effort. And the thing is that these songs, they have such an interesting... They're not connected in the standard way that you would string an album together. That's what I find interesting. There's a track called Shadow of the Bride, which sounds like the Kinks. But then there's a track called I Only Want to Be Your Clown, which I think is absolutely brilliant. It sounds like Sounds Great When You're Dead by Robin Hitchcock. Except not acoustic. And then there's a track called When She's Lost Your Mind, which is a very swirling reverb guitar, almost... Part of me, when I just saw the title, made me think of the Rain Parade at the same time, because they have that song, What She's Done to Your Mind, but it's that same kind of swirling psychedelia, or neo-psychedelia, if you will.
Yep.
Disc 2 is the kind of darker disc. And funnily enough, on that disc is a revisitation or reimagination of the old Translator song, Unalone, which is very different. You know, it's funny. When you listen to the original version, it's very upbeat, very poppy, very early 80s. It's a great, I'm going to go on a limb and say, buoyant and happy tune. But when you hear the stripped-down version, it's very dark and very sad and mournful. You know, because the opening line, you know, when you take it from one context to the other, sometimes it feels like there's going to be a war today. It sounds so heavy and so depressing in this new version.
Yeah.
You know, whereas the original version, the band version or the Translator version, has that kind of peppiness of, well, sometimes it feels like there's going to be a war today, but what am I going to be able to do about it? I'm just thinking about myself and, you know, what I'm going through. You know, it's that kind of juxtaposition, but yeah. You know, there's also a song called Northwest Girl, which is a very orchestral sounding, very elegiac piano piece that's just stunning. You know, it sounds like it was recorded in a great concert hall, because it has that kind of nuance, that kind of texture, that kind of feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Tearing Out the Roses, I think, is the masterpiece of the album. And first of all, it sounds like a hymn.
You had a secret garden where other roses grew, where the laughter and the shadows were never me and you.
Think about it and you listen to it, the way it's arranged, but the lyrics are just so painful. I'm tearing out these roses, they only make me cry. Talk about a relationship loss.
Yeah. Jeez. Right.
Well, and then the third, I'm sorry, I was just going to say, on the third disc, it's great. It's upbeat. There's a track called Where Did I Go Wrong? It sounds like an old Graham Gouldman kind of song. It's got that, you know, Things We Said Today, bus stop feel with the A minor chord. So it's got that kind of vibe. And there's a track called I Fly, which, I mean, it ends the album in a really, in a very tasteful and very satisfying way, because the tagline of the song is, I fucking love you.
I'll take it. Well, that's the thing. You're talking about a guy who has shown over the years the songwriting chops to warrant three full records worth of material. And it's nice to know that he actually comes through with it all.
Right. I mean, there are a few covers that obviously were just labors of love, if you will.
Yep.
And meant for fun. Like, there's a very T-Rex take on the old Stone song Dandelion.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So it's that kind of thing where he's just doing something for the pleasure of doing it. That's the key thing about this album. I think that's why he did it in such a manner, because he obviously loves being able to record and perform. He's got his own home studio now in up in Portland, Oregon. And it was a good time had by all.
There's also that's excellent. And there's also music out this week from Allie McManus, who was the other end of the spectrum. Not exactly just getting her start, but at 21 years old, she's obviously very new to the business. Who is she? Where's she from?
She is a singer, songwriter, pianist, and guitarist from Detroit. And this is her her debut mini album. Because, you know, it's, I'm not going to split hairs, but, you know, it's only seven songs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to me, it's like an EP, really, you know. But they're long, they're of length, you know. So they're fully fleshed out, you know, and fully realized. And that's the thing. For someone this age to deliver such fully matured material on a debut record, you know, it's, she's a young woman, but she's kind of got an old soul. His first record was produced by the legendary Jack Douglas. You know, if you don't know his name, I mean, really, I shouldn't have to school you, but Cheap Trick, John and Yoko.
Yep.
You know, let's start there, and I don't have to say anything more than that. She has a very sweet and very warm voice. She definitely has the voice of a young person that hasn't been tainted, if you will, by the ugliness of what the life in the music industry will do to you. Her voice sounds very bright and fresh. The songs are all drawn from personal experience, especially the title track, Unbreakable. It's a very moving piece. And that's the thing. These songs will touch you. If you're not moved by them, you don't have a soul. And I will get to the reason why, because I didn't write it in the review, because I don't want that to be the reason why I want somebody to hear this record.
In the same way as the Jeff Healey band, right.
You know, the song Unbreakable, the lyrics are, I am what I am, and I love where I stand. Yeah, I can't stand for long, but I'm going strong, and I'm unbreakable. That's how it's pronounced. The thing is, Allie McManus is a young woman in a wheelchair. She's had numerous surgeries over the years to try and correct a spinal problem that just, you know, it's there. And so she does this from a wheelchair. And she doesn't seem to be fazed by any of it, and God bless her for it, and more power to her. The main thing is she's delivered some very powerful and mature songs from, like I said, someone who's only 21 years old.
Yeah.
You know, she sings, you know, she can sing and hit high notes where she's not overreaching. And you get that more often than not from somebody who's trying to show off that they may have the vocal abilities. She sings in her range and it works perfectly. Like I said, her voice has that sweetness, that youthfulness. It still hasn't been tainted by time or negativity or jadedness.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to see what else she's got in the tank, because at 21 years old, obviously, she's got a lot to say already, so we'll see what she's able to follow up with. But this one, definitely worth checking out, and of course, you can find the review elsewhere on popdose.com. And we've got a few more things to talk about before we get to In Our Heads, not the least of which is a tour of the United States, and I think you've already got your tickets to go see Mike Nesmith and Mickey Dolenz out for the first time, the two of them, in how long?
That's the first time ever that the two of them are going out.
Yeah, because Mickey and Peter went out a ton, and Mickey, Peter, and Davey went out a ton, and occasionally Mike would go out with one of the other guys. But yeah, for the first time, Mike and Mickey together. This is going to be interesting to watch.
And don't forget, Mickey and Davey used to go out also.
Right, right.
And perform together. The thing is, they had talked about this for years and years and years, going back to the days of the Monkees, when they were going to just go out if the way they described it at the time, it really sounded like a forerunner to what became Unplugged, you know?
Yep.
It was just them going out as a duo. But, you know, the idea of them together, because when you hear their harmonies, even at this age, they still have it. There is something magical about the voices of Nesmith and Dolenz together.
Right.
No different than when you hear Lennon singing with McCartney, mm-hmm. or you've got Clark, Hicks, and Nash, you know? Dolenz and Nesmith have a certain magic about them. And I think it's a great buffer to when Mike Nesmith is out there and has somebody like Mickey as his foil on stage with him. I think it makes him even looser. Now, you've seen him perform live. I've seen him twice. You know, I didn't get to see the first National Band redo. Hopefully they'll bring that east.
Yeah.
But you know, I have seen him perform twice in two very different venues, and he was magnificent both times. To have Mickey with him, I think, will make it even more interesting and lively. And, you know, I can picture them on stage together doing things like, obviously, Papa Jean's Blues, where those harmonies are seamless.
Right.
Or Pleasant Valley Sunday, naturally, or The Door Into Summer. You know, it's just so, what am I doing hanging around? You told me, you think about Sunny Girlfriend, you think about the songs that those two sang as one, and they're so locked in with each other that it's a near impossibility to not think that it's going to be anything less than really terrific, frankly.
Yeah. No doubt. And speaking of really terrific, we've talked many, many times, although it's been a while, about one of the other writers here on Pop Dose that has given us great insights into the soul music scene for a very long time. Ken Shane did the Soul Serenade column for years and years and years and still does, and has added to it now a little something that he likes to call hot buttered soul.
Gee.
Where to begin, right?
Would that be my wheelhouse, perhaps?
Yeah, you think?
The sweet soul sounds of Stax Records of Memphis, Tennessee, with the holy trinity of Isaac Hayes' big three albums, newly remastered and reissued on vinyl with the original Enterprise Records label. This is coming from the reissues arm, if you will, the Rhino Records sequel from Concord Bicycle Music Group,
mm-hmm.
called Kraft Recordings. And they have re-released Hot Buttered Soul, which was Isaac's, I think, his masterpiece. I think it's still more of his masterpiece than Black Moses, which they reissued in the original fold-out triptych cover.
Right.
And, of course, my theme song, the Shaft soundtrack.
Shut your mouth.
I'm talking about Sean Shaft.
Yeah, and I mean, again, with Ken at the keyboard writing about this stuff, he has a better...
It's the second nature element for him to be able to write with such wonderful sense of detail, appreciation, and not overanalyzing it, because he just loves the stuff.
Exactly, and he makes it real. He makes it pop off the page. So, again, go. Do that thing. Read all of Ken's words. You will be a better person for it, and follow him into the music as well.
And then go buy those three albums while they're on vinyl. You will be rock hard afterwards. The minute you hear Isaac singing the 9-minute version of Walk On By with that staggering break where he goes, "You put the hurt on me, mama. You socked it to me. When you said goodbye." I mean, that is just a fucking moment.
Now, as we get to the In Our Head segment, this is where we end up the show every week, and we just talk about a little something that was kind of wandering through our brains, and I have to hand this one back to you from just minutes ago here on the program, because I've had a few things that were rolling through my head, but none of them got to me like what you just mentioned when we were talking about Mike and Mickey going out on tour, because you mentioned one of my all-time favorite Monkees songs, The Door into Summer. And it was not one that they wrote. However, it was one. I don't think anybody else has ever done a recording of that one, or at least not one that went anywhere.
There's a live bootleg version out there by Sugar.
Oh, really? Okay.
Their first shows, that was one of the songs that they did. Funnily enough, just before you and I got together tonight, I was watching a concert of the Monkees from 2013, and they actually did, for the first time ever, Door into Summer live.
Excellent. Well, and let me take a brief respite from this to let you know, we handed off the whole conversation that we had last time around about The Midnighters, and there's new stuff out from them that we'll talk about next time around as well.
But, absolutely.
But that came to me by way of Peter David Case. Peter Case was the lead singer of the Plimsolls, and had mentioned them, or mentioned a song that they did that the Plimsolls used to do live all the time. Peter Case put up a video this week, and I can never remember the name of it, but Green Day has a kind of a sidebar act that they do, that, you know, with Billy Joe.
Foxborough Hot Tubs.
Yes, right. And it was a version of them covering A Million Miles Away by the Plimsolls. And it's excellent. So good for them for, you know, going back and bringing that thing full circle. But The Door into Summer is, not only is it a great song, but it is a reference to a book title. The book was by Robert Heinlein, and Heinlein, I can take or leave, but that's where I want to go with the In Our Head segment this week, is the music that has literary references all over it. And The Door into Summer is one of those. Certainly, I mean, Led Zeppelin, if it wasn't for J.R.R. Tolkien, half of the Zeppelin catalog goes out the window. And there have been great songs written that were inspired by books and inspired by authors. And, you know, the themes start to show up again and again in the works of certain people. And I wonder if there is a song like that that you listened to and you went, you know what? I get what they're talking about, and what they're talking about came out of a book.
Killing an Arrow by The Cure. The what? Stranger, Albert Camus.
I can turn and walk away, or I can fire the gun. Staring at the sky, staring at the sun. Whichever I choose, it amounts to the same. Absolutely nothing. I'm alive.
The thing is, you know, when I was younger, I loved those first two Cure albums were just an absolute must. You know, and I still recommend them highly for anyone and everyone. And I just loved the fact that they were such a literary-oriented band. Not so much, you know, here's the thing. Weller tried it with Absolute Beginners, which is a book by Colin McInnes, which is such a wonderfully cinematic book when you read it, but the song has nothing to do with the lyrics.
Right.
I mean, the song doesn't have anything to do with the book. I'm sorry. You know, there was a movie that was made of Absolute Beginners, which actually destroyed a company called Palace Pictures. But the thing is that, again, it misses the mark completely lyrically. There's no connection. But it led me to find the book.
Mm-hmm.
Which you can almost never get anymore. I know it's going to sound really weird, but Mother, I don't particularly care for the song, but Mother by John Lennon actually came from his reading about Primal Scream and going through Primal Scream therapy by Arthur Janov, with Arthur Janov. So those are the main things that I can think of. Now, interestingly enough, The Fall named themselves after another Albert Camus book.
Right.
You know, they were originally going to call themselves The Strangers, but there was some band already that was called The Strangers, so they couldn't do that. So, you know, I forget, because I know that there are a lot more songs than that out there that have definitive literary references.
Well, you even have concept albums. Randy Newman, many, many years ago, I think back in 94 or 95, did an album called Randy Newman's Faust. And so I had a long conversation many, many years ago with Paul Williams. And we talked about the movie that he made, The Phantom of the Paradise, which is half Phantom of the Opera and half Faust. I mean, that book was the jumping off point for so many different people getting creative over it, you know, and Randy Newman's version of it notwithstanding, most of it is excellent because it's really, I mean, it's the main themes of just the headwaters of good and the headwaters of evil going at each other. So that's cool. And it gets all the way down as goofy as Loggins and Messina doing the house at Pooh Corner.
Well, first of all, you brought up Robert Heinlein. The song Friends by The Police.
Yep.
I like to eat my friends and make no bones about it. I like to eat my friends, I couldn't do without it. Paint a man or a poet friend, I know just how you'll taste. Your limbs go sliding down my throat and never go to waste.
It's about grokking your friends, and that comes out of Heinlein's
right.
Strange Land.
Yep.
Then there's the song Standards by The Jam off the This Is the Modern World album, and that's him trying to put 1984 into lyrics.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
We make the standards and we make the rules, and if you don't abide by them, you know, and the last line says, look, you know what happened to Winston. You know, making reference to Winston Smith.
Yep.
Later on, Weller, on the first Style Council album, had a song called The Whole Point of No Return, in which he's paraphrasing. And this is really obscure, but he's paraphrasing from a book that was written at the turn of the 20th century called The Ragged Trousered Philanthropists by Robert Tressel, which is an incredible read because it's of its time. Really, if you want to talk about the foundations of socialism in the utopian manner, you'll find it right there.
Yeah.
But then Don't Stand So Close to Me.
Oh, right, which mentions Nabokov.
Lolita.
Yep.
You know, so, but as well we know, that fucking guy just loves to throw in literary references because, you know, he's just so clever.
Exactly. Well, we've got the comment section down below so you can add some more of your own choosing if there's a song that you can think of. And this is one that we'll revisit because I know there are more that will come to both of us. So, Rob Ross, at that, we're going to have to let this one go for this week. But that is episode 50, well, depending on your count, 55 or 56 of the show. And thank you once again for joining me, man. It was great fun.
No, it's always a joy, and obviously I want to say that we have another fan, my mother-in-law, who I want to send a shout-out to because she's begun listening.
Well, hello to Rob's mother-in-law.
She finds the show very entertaining, and that, to me, says everything.
Good man.
So, I will speak to you next week. Have a great week. Stay well. Stay safe.